Hi, this is Jim Cunningham. Have you ever wondered what is the difference between a trust and a will? What's going on? What's the big deal with living trusts? So, what we're talking about here are living trusts. Why do people do these? Isn't a will good enough? Do you even need a will? Well, we're going to talk about the difference, and there are differences. It is very, very important to understand this because it doesn't matter if you're rich, if you're not so rich. This is a really big deal, the difference between a will and a trust. So, very beneficial information for you, for your family, your loved ones, your friends, whatever it is, people you care about. And if you don't care about those people, then don't share the information, right? But it's very important to understand a will only handles things after death. Well, a living trust handles things after death as well. A living trust manages while a person is living. So if I set up a living trust and I have a stroke and I can't do for myself, if I'm, you know, if I'm can't sign a check or a deed or whatever it is, my living trust can manage my assets. So that happened with my in-laws. They had a very long period of incapacity. They unfortunately got Alzheimer's, went into assisted living and passed away. Fortunately, they had a living trust. So my wife was able to use that trust to manage their affairs instead of having to go to probate court to manage their affairs. And that's a conservatorship. So if a, and you can think of a will as a sort of vague punch list of instructions. You know, I appoint Bob as my executor and he's to distribute everything equally among my children. There's not a whole lot of guidance, right? A living trust really is a detailed prearranged plan that operates the moment you sign it. So this is very important. A will is not legally effective until the person who wrote the will dies, right? So that has a whole host of issues. Like, is this really the person's will, right? That's what probate's for. Probate is from the Latin probare, to prove that that will is the last will and testament of the person who passed away. A living trust is valid from the beginning. It's a contract, frankly. And so it's valid from the beginning. Another very important distinction, very, very important distinction. Probate is designed to protect creditors. It is not designed to protect people who inherit the property. Let me say that again. Probate is designed to protect creditors. A living trust is designed to protect the people that you're leaving your assets to. Lawyers call those beneficiaries, the people who get the goods, the bene from Latin, right? The people who get the goods. A living trust, the primary function of a living trust is to provide for those beneficiaries, not for creditors. Now, a living trust does not provide creditor protection, and we'll talk about that, but it is significantly a heavier lift for creditors if they want to enforce their creditor rights with a living trust than it is in probate, and we'll talk about that. So we've got our attorneys here at Cunningham Legal. You can see those if you're watching this on video. We have offices throughout the state of California, in the Sacramento Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and Los Angeles area. If you're watching this on YouTube, please go ahead and subscribe to our YouTube channel and share this. You know, this is an important video, right? We're going to take a 60,000 foot level, and many people that you may know could benefit from this information. Very important to understand. I'm a lawyer. I've been in practice 30 years. I'm talking. If you're listening to this or if you're watching this is not legal advice, okay? So don't just watch this video and go and do a bunch of stuff. Again, you should be doing this with a qualified attorney. I wrote a book about this, Savvy Estate Planning, what you need to know before you hire the right lawyer. There's a whole book on how to hire a lawyer, right? And the third edition is here coming out very shortly. So let's start. What is a will? What is it? Well, wills go back to Egypt, that 2500 BC. One of the oldest wills ever found is where the person who passed away left his property to his wife if she did not, quote, pull down the houses that he owned, right? So there was a stipulation that she can have that, but she's got to not basically tear everything down. Who knows what happened in that marriage? I don't know. But that's from 2500 BC, you know, 4,500 years ago, quite a long time ago. Roman law, so fast forward 2,500 years, Roman law significantly influenced the development of wills, introducing formalized procedures. So before then, not so formalized, but the Romans, of course, were very organized people, building roads, courts, and civic structures like court proceedings, right? And that sort of changed the legal standards. And then during the medieval period, wills became under the purview of the Catholic Church, or at that time just the Church before the split of Catholicism into Eastern and Western. And that was the church court dealt with matters of the spirit, of the soul. Wills dealt with dead people, and so therefore it became part of the church court. That's really where probate court comes from. So you may not realize this, but that we have civil courts and we have probate courts. Well, the probate court is the court that handles really affairs of the soul still. So when people pass away, if people become incapacitated, if you're going through a guardianship proceeding or an adoption, that guardianship happens in probate court. So very important to understand that we still have this division, right, between probate and civil courts, and they are two really separate tracks. Then we had the Statute of Wills in 1540 under King Henry VIII, right? Among the many things that he's famous for is passing the Statute of Wills, which got him a lot more property, frankly, but really sort of modernized the passage of property. So now people can make a will, or for the last 500 years, people have been able to make a will and really leave the property to whom they want. That is not the same on the continent of Europe. They do have something called usufruct, which is usum fructum, which is a use of the fruits, so that the children get essentially a forced share. There's really no way around that. We don't have that in Anglo-American law. So here in England and Australia and the other English-speaking countries, we have this ability to leave property to whomever we want. So that becomes effective after death. So what is, what is a will? It's a document that outlines your wishes. So it says, when I die, these assets are distributed in a certain manner. You can name a guardian in your will. California also lets you name a guardian outside of your will. Now, you might be thinking, well, why would you do that? Well, you might not be around, right? So you may be serving in the military and you're the only parent. You get deployed. You may have to have a guardianship for your minor child. The other issue that comes up is incapacity. So if somebody has a stroke or some other type of issue, the fact that the guardian is nominated in the will means that that's a legal document only if you die. So if you're alive, there's a question about, is that really, certainly it's evidence for the court of who you would want to choose, but there is a standalone guardianship document. And we typically, if people have minor children, that's something we discuss in the meeting when we meet. Sometimes it's appropriate, sometimes it's not, for a variety of reasons. The will typically names an executor, right? A will actually doesn't even have to name an executor, but typically it does. This executor is the one who executes, right? That's where the term comes from, who carries out the terms of the will. And they take on the personal liability and the personal responsibility for carrying out the wishes of the person who's passed away. So if you're wondering what is an executor, right? The executor carries out the terms of the will. In California, we have four different types of executor. There's an executor, there's something called an administrator. So if you're looking at this, if you're involved in a probate proceeding, you say, well, there's no executor, there's an administrator. Typically, that means if there's no will. So if a person dies without a will, that is meaning dying intestate, right? So, or without a valid will. So you might have signed a document that you thought was a will, but later the court says, oh, it's not witnessed, right? There's some defect in the will. Or somebody says, oh, there's a later will. So in that will that you sign, you don't have to name an executor, but if you don't have a will, that's an administrator. If you have, you might also see executor or administrator with will annexed. Administrator with will annexed means if there's no named executor, which frankly doesn't happen that often, or all the named executors refuse to serve or can't serve or whatever it is, they just say, I'm not going to do it. That's where you might see that administrator with will annexed. There's also something called a special administrator. The special administrator is serving as essentially the quote executor pending the admission of a will to probate. So if there's an emergency thing that has to happen during the probate proceeding, if the person left a will and they had a business, but you need to make payroll, the court may appoint a special administrator to carry out sort of emergency powers. But after the will author's death, the will generally goes through probate. So California has a two-track system. One is by affidavit. So if the assets are under a certain amount of dollar amount, then there's no formal court proceeding. And if they're over a dollar amount, and I believe that's currently $184,500. And again, this number changes every 2 years. I believe we're set for another change in 2025. So we're recording this in 2024. And if you're watching this in 2026, that number probably will be higher. There's also another change afoot in the law having to do with the principal residence or the primary residence of a person who passes away, different set of rules. And we'll cover that in a different webinar. So after a person who creates the will passes away, that will goes through the probate process. So it's a court supervised process in California to validate the will to make sure it's the decedent's last will, as well as to pay the creditors. And we'll talk about that, pay the creditors and then and then distribute the assets. So probate takes a long time. It's 16 to 24 months in California. the shortest possible time, a sort of we call full blown or formal probate. It's not where you're putting on a tuxedo and, you know, walking with a cane and a top hat. And you're not putting on a prom dress. This is a formal probate is a noticed proceeding, and there are time intervals that are required in a probate. And again, this is very high level discussion of what probate is. So there these time intervals, and the absolute maximum, the shortest period of time, right, is about 9 months. So you really can't conclude a probate in under 9 months. That's sort of the minimum, maybe eight. But again, all the stars have to be aligned. The judge has to show up on time. The people who work at the court have to do their job. The people that you have to, the third parties that you have to deal with have to do their job timely. So again, on average, so if you're starting probate and you're wondering how long does this take, about 16 to 24 months from the time that you initially meet with the lawyer to start the process. Probate fees can be 100% of the estate. And you may be thinking, what the heck? 100% of the estate? Probate fees are based on a percentage of the estate. And we have a probate fee calculator we'll have shown in another slide where you can actually calculate, you know, if you have $1 million estate, how much your probate fee is going to be. And those run typically 4 to 8%, just broadly speaking, but they can be 100%. So if the problem with probate is they figure the fees based on the gross value of the assets, not the net value. So if you have $1 million home with a $950,000 mortgage, that's $50,000 net. The attorney and executor fees are about $50,000. So what's going to end up happening is the attorney and the executor end up with money and the beneficiaries get nothing, right, under that. So that's where I get that 100% figure. The probate proceeding is a public proceeding. So this is really, really important to understand. Living trusts are private. Now, it is true that the people who are named in the trust and the people who would inherit in the absence of a trust are entitled to know the contents of the trust. Well, that kind of makes sense. But the public in general, broadly speaking, is not entitled to know what's in the trust. You can go to any court in the state of California, walk up to the clerk's window and ask them, I would like a file. You have to identify what it is. The estate of, you know, Jones, I want to see that file. And in that file, depending on where you're at in the court proceeding, but let's say you're toward the end of the proceeding, you will know who is inheriting, how much people are inheriting, when they're inheriting, the terms under which they're inheriting. Is it outright? Is it in a trust? Is it some other type of arrangement? And I will tell you, that information is sold. So something to be aware of is if you're leaving money to someone who might be getting, you know, taken advantage of, or maybe somebody who's whatever, you know, you can come up with why that would be a bad idea to make that public. That is a public disclosure. So the identity of the person and typically even their address, like where they live. So if you're concerned about remaining private and keeping things confidential, a living trust is a much better way to go. So having only a will, and this is very important to understand, having only a will in place subjects your estate to probate. Probate in California is a formal process with some pretty significant hurdles and rules. This is not the same in other states. Now, you may say, I don't live in California, so it's not a problem. Let's say you live in New Jersey and you own a home in maybe a vacation home in California and you pass away with the will. You're going to have to do, well, you won't, you'll be dead, right? Your family or your executor is going to file a probate in New Jersey and then have to file an ancillary probate in California. You can't close the New Jersey probate until the California probate's closed. So it's very important, certainly if you have real estate in multiple states, that can be very problematic and why you really want to think about a trust. Because some states, and this is common in some states, they don't use trusts as much. And that's because they have what is more like what we call a summary probate proceeding. Well, there is stuff to do on a living trust that we'll talk about. When a person passes away, there's stuff that you have to do. In other states, the probate process may not be nearly as burdensome as it is in California, but it's important to understand that even if you're a resident of one of those states that may not be as burdensome of a probate process, if you own real property in California, it will be burdensome because you're going to have to open a probate in your state and then the full probate in California. So very important to understand if you own property in multiple states. So let's look at $3 million estate. You can check out our probate fee calculator on our website, cunninghamlegal.com. A $3 million estate, the attorney gets $43,000. That is the maximum fee that an attorney can charge. Most attorneys charge the maximum fee. So that's just kind of how it is. The executor gets a similar commission is what it's called. So the attorney gets a fee, the executor gets a compensation. commission, and the total is $86,000 on $3 million. Now, I will tell you, if you have a $3 million estate, setting up your living trust and maybe amending it a few times and maybe even doing a restatement and then doing what we call trust administration, which is all the stuff you do when somebody dies or becomes incapacitated, because basically here's the how the real world works. Probate is a process that's complicated, okay? Your family still has to go through essentially the same process with a living trust, but we call it trust administration. Most attorneys do that on an hourly basis. And so it's really hard to get to $43,000 in hourly fees on a $3 million trust administration. It is possible, but that typically is, you know, it's significantly less than that is what we're seeing in a normal sort of uncontested trust administration where there's not, where there aren't a lot of problems, quite frankly. You know, if you have a jerk brother who's causing a lot of problems, yeah, that's going to run fees up. So that is the fee. By the way, there are fees for what are called extraordinary services. So that is not a cap on fees, that $43,000. So if you're selling property, if you're involved in litigation, whatever it is, those fees can be higher. These fees are approved by the court. They are paid from the estate, and they're paid at the end of the matter. Okay, so just understand, if it takes 16 to 24 months, typically that lawyer is not getting paid for 16 or 24 months. That's why lawyers typically charge the maximum statutory fee, because they have to work. Imagine, you know, working on a job for 2 years, getting paid 2 years after you start a job. And it's, you know, probate is a lot of work. And so for that, for those reasons, a lot of attorneys will not discount their fees. But it's important to understand, certainly if you could ask somebody to discount their fees, but most attorneys that know what they're doing just simply don't. What is a trust? So what are we talking about? There are literally many, many kinds of trusts. And, you know, if you like ice cream, 31 flavors, I just picked 31 just to be kind of, I don't know, humorous. There are a lot of different types of trusts. So a lot of different attributes. The big ones we're going to talk about, or the big one we're going to talk about, is a revocable living trust. So by default, if the trust does not say if it's revocable or irrevocable under California law, that trust is revocable. Now, a well-written trust will say somewhere in the document that the trust is revocable. And it's very important. There should be a mechanism in the trust that describes how to amend the trust, because there have been a string of court cases recently that say you have to follow the way that trust says an amendment has to be done. So you do a trust, you leave everything equally to your kids, you name your oldest kid as a successor trustee, that kid moves to the UK, living in London, that person should not be trustee. In order to be trustee, you have to be subject to the jurisdiction of a state of the United States. And so being in the UK makes it a foreign trust, brings on a whole bunch of other different issues. So if you say, gee, I don't want that kid to be trustee, I want my sister to be trustee, you would amend the trust, right, to name your sister as trustee. So you have a trust with an amendment that takes out your kid and names your sister as trustee. When you do that amendment, you can't just write on the trust. Don't do that. You can't scribble and write a name in there. But that trust is amendable, so it's revocable. You could revoke the whole thing, and it's also amendable, and the amendment has to be effectuated in the manner provided in the trust. So this very clear law, these string of cases came down very recently, and so it's very important to think about that. If you're thinking about amending your trust, you really do need to follow how the process for the amendment is written in the trust. So what we have is the revocable living trust. That becomes irrevocable by the terms of the trust. So typically it says when somebody dies, it becomes irrevocable. So we're going to talk about a revocable trust that becomes irrevocable. And under California law, if the person who holds the power to amend or revoke the trust becomes incapacitated, that trust is irrevocable under California law, even though under the terms of the trust, it may not say it's irrevocable. So it's very important to understand. So you cannot amend an irrevocable trust, right? So the trustee can't amend. Let's say a person gets sick and can't serve as trustee of their own living trust, and someone else is starting to serve as trustee, but really they say, gee, some of these terms should be changed. Well, that's irrevocable. You can't do it. There's a way around that we're going to talk about. So lots of different trusts. We're going to focus primarily on the living trust, and these other trusts, we cover these in other videos on YouTube. So how does a living trust work? This is a revocable trust, a revocable living trust. Well, a living trust is like a bucket with a handle. So it's a bucket. You put your stocks, your bonds, your mutual funds, you put your NVIDIA shares in there, you put your Apple shares, you put your vacation home, your primary residence, all that goes in your trust. There's a handle, and the trustee holds onto the handle, right? So these assets are in your trust. What does not go in your trust? Very, very important. IRAs, 401ks, annuities, life insurance, do not go in the trust, right? While you're alive, those things stay out. Those are all essentially contracts, right? So the annuity life insurance is a contract that really doesn't involve the trust. The 401k, the IRA are held by a third party custodian for your benefits. So the legal title to those assets, because you haven't yet been taxed on those are for retirement. Those assets are held by a third party custodian, and you really can't put those into your trust. In fact, if you try and put your IRA into the trust, that'll be a deemed distribution and you'll pay a bunch of tax. So no one's going to do it. So all trusts must have a trustee, a beneficiary, and a corpus or a body or stuff. Okay. Trusts have been around since the Crusades. They've been around about 1,000 years. And what happened is people would go to the Crusades. They say, I'm going to go to Jerusalem and, you know, fight. I'm going to ride my horse. I think the instruction was from England, you cross the channel, go to France, and when they start speaking Italian, make a right, and then catch a ship over to, you know, the Holy Land. That was the basic instructions. So that is, so why are we talking about the Crusades? It's because people would leave for 2 or 3 years, and they had an estate, and they had property, and so they would entrust a friend or somebody they knew orally. So this is nothing in writing. So trusts originally were oral trusts, meaning I entrust you with my property. And then they would come back a few years later and say, I want my lands back. And the guy says, well, you know, you gave me your property, get lost. And so the crusader went to the king, and the king said, well, you know, this is really between you and God. And so go to the church court, and then the church court would enforce the trust, right? And so that's kind of the origin of trust. So fast forward 1,000 years, we do have written documents, right, that are trust. So an oral trust won't work. But all trusts have to have a trustee, somebody in charge, a beneficiary. So if you do a living trust, you are the beneficiary while you're alive. You are the trustee while you're alive, typically. And the stuff is, it starts with $10 or a peppercorn. We learned that in law school, a little peppercorn, a dollar, whatever it is, but typically it's $10. You see that. So if you see that on your living trust, like, why does it say $10? Well, there's a recitation of something of value. Some attorneys, I see them tape a $10 bill on there. I've seen that. That's kind of, I don't know, kind of interesting. So trust has a handle. It's a bucket. You put stuff in the bucket. And when you stop being trustee, you resign, you pass away, you become incapacitated, that bucket passes to the next trustee. So it might pass to your sister, right, who holds on to the handle of that bucket. Now, those assets are still for you while you're alive, right? But when you pass away, those assets are your sister holding onto the bucket. If she's the trustee after you pass away, then she's maybe distributing those to your kids, right, or holding on to them for your children. So what this does is this allows your sister to use your assets to take care of you while you're incapacitated and avoid probated death. So that's kind of how that works differently than a will. So if you had a will that's effective only at death, you get sick, you become incapacitated, your sister may still care for you, but she's going to have to go to probate court and file a petition for a conservatorship, which is kind of like a living probate, also known as a living hell. A conservatorship, if you've been through it, it's pretty burdensome. California calls it a conservatorship. Other states call it a guardianship. California just draws a distinction for whatever reason. There are strategies available to protect your financial legacy for your heirs, right? Your children, your beneficiaries, from divorce, taxes, and lawsuits. Think about this. If you have a child who's married, you may really like your son-in-law. You may not like your son-in-law. You really may like your daughter-in-law. You may not like your daughter-in-law, right? So realistically, what happens, what I see in the real world, I've been doing this 30 years, when mom and dad die and the children inherit the property, a lot of times that just kind of goes into a common bucket with the spouse. Sometimes people get a divorce. Sometimes what you've worked a lifetime to accumulate and save does get split it does go to your child, but sometimes it goes to the ex-spouse. So really important to pay attention to that. I would say most law firms don't really pay attention to this enough. Increasingly they are, but certainly if you're trying to find an attorney to set up an estate plan, that's really something I would ask that attorney. What can I do to protect the inheritance I'm going to leave my son or my daughter? What can I do to protect that inheritance from a divorcing spouse, right? Half of all marriages end in divorce. Half of marriages end in death, right? I guess those are the two options. But there are strategies available to protect those assets from going to the people that you don't want them to go to. Now, sometimes I did meet with a client once. She says, well, I really do like my son-in-law better than I like my daughter. So, but that's, that may be you. I don't know, right? But again, a revocable trust typically becomes irrevocable, unamendable. You can't change it when somebody dies. So a living trust is amendable during your lifetime. Abel and Baker create a living trust. They transfer their home and rental by deed to the trust. So how do you fund real estate? We have a whole webinar on this. How do you fund real estate to a living trust? You do a deed. It's not enough to list it on your living trust. That's not enough. You have to do a deed transferring the property to the trust. And title to the property often reads Abel and Baker Chen, trustees or successor trustees of the Chen Trust, dated October 17, 2024, which is an auspicious date. This is the date we're recording this. It's the anniversary date of the big earthquake in 89. And any amendments there too. Transfer bank accounts and savings accounts to the trust. How do you do that? Well, you typically have to go in person to the bank, right? Sometimes you can do it online, but, and this should be Abel Chen and Baker Chen, trustees of the Chen Trust, shouldn't be Lopez if you're looking at this. The bank may ask who the successor trustees are of your trust. So typically the recorder's office, when you record a deed, is not going to ask you for the successor trustees, but banks are starting to ask who the successor trustees are. And this, you can transfer your brokerage accounts, LLC units. So if you have a property that is owned by an LLC, you have to be very careful when you transfer those LLC units to a trust. Because if you own real property with that LLC and the owners of the LLC are not exactly the same owners as the trust, meaning they're not literally the exact owners, that can cause a reassessment. So you have to be very, very careful. Stocks and bonds, but not IRAs, life insurance and annuities, those stay out of the trust. So how do we handle life insurance? If Abel and Baker are setting up a trust, Abel has life insurance and makes Baker the primary beneficiary. That's very common, and the trust, the secondary beneficiary. Now, you may say to me, well, Jim, why wouldn't you make the trust the first beneficiary? Well, if Abel dies and has creditors, right, it may be better if Baker takes out life insurance, okay? That just may be better than if it goes to the living trust, because although I did say that probate is designed to pay creditors more than it is to get assets to your loved ones, creditors can still get paid from assets of the living trust. Abel's creditors can still go after the assets in Abel's living trust, but it's a more circuitous path. It's a harder, it's a heavier lift for the creditors. And a lot of times, if it's a small amount, the creditor goes away. By the way, I'm not advocating not paying your bills. So, but sometimes you have a creditor that's a real questionable creditor, and this is a real issue for people, or can be an issue for people. So, IRAs, Abel, typically what happens is, Baker might name Abel as the beneficiary of Baker's IRA, then Sam and Debbie, their children. It's very important to remove an ex-spouse as beneficiary. So what am I talking about here? If you have gotten a divorce in California, under law, unless you otherwise state in your divorce proceeding, your ex-spouse is not legally entitled to things through beneficiary designations, would actually include a living trust, include life insurance, it would include annuities, IRAs. The problem is if you have to change that, all right? Because if Abel's ex-spouse is a beneficiary and Baker is married to Abel, if Abel's ex-spouse makes it to that institution before Baker does, right? Baker with the divorce papers, right? Proving that the spouse is no longer the beneficiary, that ex-spouse can get the money. And then Baker's going to have to chase after the ex-spouse for the money. So very, very important, very important. There was actually a very well-publicized case in 2024 from the U.S. Supreme Court where somebody 30 years before dying named a girlfriend as the beneficiary of an IRA. That person died. That person's spouse did not get the money. It went to the girlfriend from 30, 35 years ago, and it was over $1 million. So really pay attention to this, people. And the best way to figure out who is your beneficiary is reach out to your institution and say, hey, if I died today, who gets this? They're going to tell you, right? And then you can fix it, right? It's an easy fix you can do on your own. Annuity, a non-qualified annuity, typically the trust should, if you have an annuity and you're married, so a surviving spouse has far more settlement options on an annuity than if it's left to a trust. So again, we should take this with a slowdown, right? When you're doing your estate planning, if you have an annuity, who should the beneficiary be? Generally, it's going to be the spouse, okay? Unless there's a reason not to make it the spouse. And here's kind of the flow of an estate plan. all the assets for client one and client two. So you got a married couple. One spouse passes away. There is trust administration. Very important in California. Community property gets a full adjusted cost basis. Let me repeat that again. If you are married in California, that is a community property state. So absent some other agreement, all property held as community property receives a full adjusted cost basis. Meaning if you bought that thing for, if you bought your NVIDIA stock for a dollar and it's trading for whatever it's trading for, the surviving spouse can sell that stock free of capital gains tax, can sell the rental real estate free of capital gains tax if it sells for the date of death value close in time to the date of death. So very, very important. Very important to do trust administration. I think too many people, too many surviving spouses just say, well, I was told not to do anything for a year, so I'm not going to do anything for a year. Now, by not do anything, don't sell your house, don't get married, that kind of big stuff. Absolutely meet with your lawyer and your accountant and your financial advisor to go through this, because you may be leaving a lot of money on the table in, an extra future taxes that you could easily avoid. When the second spouse dies, another what we call adjusted cost basis, or typically step up in cost basis, again, another trust administration, and then the property goes to the beneficiaries. So how do you know if a trust is a good living trust, right? So this is kind of weird. California has something called a statutory will. What does that mean? Well, it means it's in the probate code, is a form of a will. In the probate code is a form of an advanced healthcare directive. In the probate code is a form of a durable power of attorney. California does not have a form trust. Okay. Now there are other trusts out there under the federal Internal Revenue Code, a charitable trust, a qualified personal residence trust. They're actually literally forms, right, in that code. But California does not have a sort of standard accepted codified living trust that lawyers and non-lawyers can use. So what does that mean? Well, that means every lawyer is going to have their own different approach. Some of these lawyers know what they're doing, and some obviously don't. I will tell you, I've looked at a lot of trusts in my 30 years of practice. I've seen a lot of trusts. Some are good, some are bad. How do you know? Well, a living trust should communicate legal rights, obligations, and responsibilities, number one, without involving a court, right? Because that's probate court. That is, to me, super obvious. Not all lawyers are paying enough attention to this, and we're gonna cover a very important section that you should have in your trust, or think about having in your trust if you do have a living trust. And a living trust should stand alone and give your successor trustee clear instructions and proper authority to get their job done without having to go to probate court. What am I talking about? Well, a living trust probably will end up weighing over a pound. A lot of living trusts that I see that are good living trusts are not 4 pages. They are 40. They might be 60. Now you might think, why? Why do I need a trust that long? What's going on? A lot of what's in a trust is not necessarily about you, and it's not about your family. It is containing a list, for example, of all the trustee powers. Now, California has codified the trustee powers, and I will say a bad trust says something like this. I grant my trustee all the powers that the California probate code permits a trustee to have. Now you may go, well, that's great because the document's shorter. And if we need to know a power, we just look up in the probate code and find out what the powers are. Here's the problem. If it's not in the trust and the trustee goes to do something, somebody's going to have to figure out, okay, this is what the trustee is doing. Does California law let the trustee do that? And I am not kidding. There are lawyers that are in basements in Manhattan that work at banks, and they look at a trust, and you're having some like first or second year associate who's in New York look up California trustee powers. Not a good idea. It is a really good idea to list all of the powers that the trustee has, because what happens is institutions and other humans, when looking at this trust, they're going to look at the four corners of the document. They're going to look, does a trustee have this specific authority to open a bank account, to buy and sell real estate? Well, what limitations are there on the powers? It's just best practices to have that in the trust. So again, trust should stand on its own without having to go look up a bunch of law. So here's some what if examples. What if the person you name to handle your affairs passes away before you do or refuses to serve? So you say, I name a trustee. You should probably name that's a successor trustee. By the way, when I say trustee, I mean the person currently serving as trustee. When you hear lawyers talk about successor trustee, what they're saying is The successor trustee is the person who might serve in the future, but is not presently serving as trustee. So once that successor trustee assumes the office of trustee, they drop the designation successor trustee. So when in talking with a lawyer, when lawyers talk to each other, when we use the term successor trustee, that means that that person that we're talking about is not currently serving as trustee. So what if the person you name as trustee to handle your affairs passes away before you do or doesn't want to serve? Well, then we look at a successor trustee. So I'm going to name my sister first, then my brother, then my niece, then my nephew. You know, some people go 8 or 10 people. I think probably three is enough, three alternates. And it may be hard for you if you're watching this or listening to it. You go, I don't even know who to pick as a trustee. Well, we have another webinar on that. So some people pick a trust bank. Some people pick a private professional fiduciary. You might pick a family member or a friend. You should name a trustee and have a successor. But what if you don't pass away right away? What if you, like my in-laws that I mentioned, what if you have a period of mental decline before you pass away and you really can't or shouldn't be handling your financial affairs? There should be provisions in that trust. If you're not, so if your trust says that this person, when I die, this person is trustee, right? Just one person. What if you become incapacitated? Does that person have the authority to serve while you're incapacitated? Yeah, that's what makes a trust a little bit longer, is dealing with incapacity. And what if a 14-year-old inherits more than $5,000? Well, that is going to require a guardianship, right? Well, you maybe not know that. If you're 14 and inherit more than $5,000, it's a guardianship proceeding is required. Or there's a provision in the trust that says maybe the property is distributed to a parent. Maybe it's held in trust by the trustee until that child reaches a certain age. So that's going to add a few pages to the trust. So when you add these, this is why these trusts end up, some of them are over 100 pages, right? That's why they end up so long. If you don't have this information in the trust, you're likely ending up going into probate court. So we talk about estate planning. We talk about trusts. We talk about wills. But what is an estate plan? What is that? You're going to hear that a lot if you're just new to this or you like refreshing. What is an estate plan? What are people talking about? An estate plan is a set of documents. So an estate plan is not just a living trust. An estate plan is not just a will. An estate plan, when lawyers use the term estate plan, we're talking about all those things that relate to you and your incapacity. Right, typically mental incapacity, and then passing away and the transfer of wealth from you to your loved ones. Right, living trust is part of an estate plan. There's something called a pour over will. So I know we've been really dissing wills here, but if you have a living trust, you still need a will that leaves everything to your living trust. That is called a pour over will. So best practice, living trust, pour over will. Many lawyers stop there. And I think that is a cry and shame. I think it's terrible that they don't do more than a living trust or a pour over will. I've seen this time and time again. Trust, will, that's it. Well, what about the 401k? What about the IRA? What about nominating if you have a minor child, if you're a single parent and you know that you have a medical condition that will make you mentally incapacitated while you still have a minor child, you should be doing that form, the form I mentioned earlier, which is, again, that's in the probate code, but that form you can fill out and say, look, if I'm not able to be a parent, if I'm not mentally able to be a parent, then I'm nominating this other person. And yes, you do have to go through a court proceeding, the guardianship proceeding. There is a background check that the court does because they don't want creepers being guardians. I mean, it's kind of obvious, but it's a court supervised for the entire minority, right? Until that child reaches 18, the court's supervising and continuing to supervise. Beneficiary designations on life insurance, IRAs, 401ks is part of the estate plan. So when you meet with an estate planning attorney, whether it's an attorney in our firm or another competent estate planning attorney, they're going to ask you about your IRAs and 401ks and annuities. And they're not being, overly, I don't know, trying to invade your privacy or something. But the lawyer's responsibility when you come in to do estate planning is to make sure that your assets go to the people that you want in the manner that you want. Right. And they're going to ask you, do you have any IRAs? Do you have any 401ks? Do you have annuities? And then the next one step is, well, if you have those, do you know who gets those when you pass away? Then the lawyer typically verifies, or they do a new beneficiary designation. So that typically happens in the estate planning process. Durable power of attorney for property and property management and personal affairs is a document. There is a short form document that our office uses and many, many lawyers use, a specific document. And the reason we use it is if an institution does not honor that uniform statutory form power of attorney, the institution is required to pay the attorney's fees for not honoring the document. So it's pretty severe penalty. We like to have that as a little bit of a hammer, because I will tell you, I've heard from institutions, they say, if that durable power of attorney is more than a year old, we are not going to honor it. I think that's wrong. I don't think they're following the law, but that's what we're seeing in the real world. So it's nice to have that hammer of the other uniform statutory form power of attorney, so that you can kind of waive that and say, look, you got to deal with this person. Otherwise, you're going to be paying the attorney fees. And that, but the uniform, the durable power of attorney for property handles things like IRAs, 401ks, annuities. So if you have a period of incapacity and you need to take some money out of your IRA or do something with it, that your living trust has nothing to do with your IRA while you're alive. Okay. Zero. You've got to go through the durable power of attorney on that. HIPAA authorization is the medical privacy. So this, you know, you hear about this a lot. HIPAA authorization is each state has its own rules on what constitutes an authorization. Typically, it's a document. And in California, it must be in 14-point type. So if you get a HIPAA authorization that is not in 14-point type, and if you're watching this and you go, oh my gosh, our HIPAA authorizations are in 8-point type, that technically is a violation of California law. Now, I don't think you're getting in trouble for that, but just know that that's why if you do an estate plan with our firm, people go, why is the font bigger on the HIPAA authorization? Because we use 12-point font and it's in 14. And the reason it's bigger is because that's what the law says. I think I know what they're getting at, but it's very interesting that they specified the font size. Advanced Healthcare Directive says who makes healthcare decisions for you when you are not able to articulate the decisions that you want to make. So an Advanced Healthcare Directive is a legal document that empowers somebody other than you to make medical decisions on your behalf. That is different than a POLST. A POLST is a physician's order regarding life-sustaining treatment. That's typically that pink one-page document that's kind of on almost like on really thick cardstock. That is a medical order. So what you might see, and I mentioned my in-laws, when they were in assisted living, they had a POLST and it was literally taped to their front door, right, in their facility. And it said, if this person is not breathing, do not perform CPR, right? Or don't perform this life-sustaining treatment because they're at whatever medical condition. That has to be done with a doctor. So we don't do those in the office. That is a very serious form. And I recently met with two relatives who signed the POLST thinking it was an advanced healthcare directive, which is like, what are you doing, right? And then the deed for real property. We mentioned that. We have a whole webinar, a video on our YouTube page about how to transfer real property to a living trust. So why have an estate plan? Avoid probate. They were sad when they found their wealthy grandfather had died in an earthquake. They were devastated when they discovered he had written his will on an Etch-a-Sketch in an earthquake. A little bit of earthquake humor on today, the anniversary of the 1989 earthquake in San Francisco. Save taxes, protect your legacy. So protecting your legacy, right? How does a living trust save taxes? Well, it sometimes can save taxes, not only for your estate, for larger estates, but also when your kids pass away. So if you leave money to your kids, the question is, you know, will they be wealthy and pay taxes? There are ways that you can have that go to the next generation and be outside of your kids' estate. So there are some limited use cases for avoiding or saving taxes on a living trust. Typically, people are using other irrevocable trusts to do that. Why is it important to have an updated trust? So if you have a living trust and you're watching this and you're like, why did I do that? Why is it so long? Isn't a will good enough? Laws change. Recently, we had the Corporate Transparency Act. That is going into effect big time January 1, 2025. And if you don't know what's going on, we have a webinar on the Corporate Transparency Act. I would encourage you to take a look at that. Births, deaths, divorces, health issues, life changes happen. I was on the phone today with a good friend of mine. His wife is having medical issues and they're pretty serious. And that would be a reason to revisit your estate plan. He happens to be an estate planning attorney. So if you have a spouse with some serious medical issues, I think it's an opportunity to revisit your estate plan to make sure you have everything sort of nailed down. Many times the caregiver passes away before the person receiving the care. About 60% of the time. Just remember that. It happened to my grandmother. She passed away and my grandfather was disabled. And so that was not expected in the family. And that is a very common occurrence. Tax changes. We have the estate tax sunset, right? The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act passed in 17 is expiring in 2025, at the end of 2025, and Prop 19 passed to change lots of changes to how real estate is taxed, especially when it goes from parent to child. What is a trust protector? Very, very important. A trust protector. Now, if you've never heard of this, I just want you to empty your mind a little bit. I know it's you're probably like, Jim, my brain is full. You just went through a whole bunch of stuff. But trust protector, very, very important. A trustee is the one who carries out the terms of the trust. A trust protector has power over the trust and the trustee, but is not the trustee, right? They have power over the trust. So what am I talking about here? Well, only a probate court has the power to change the terms of the trust to conform to your intent after you're gone or after that trust becomes irrevocable. So you pass away, a probate court must be involved to change the terms of the trust. And you might be saying, well, why would I want to change the terms of the trust? That's a little scary. I die and why would the terms want to be changed? What if that's not what I wanted? Well, many times these powers are exercised by the trust protector, frankly, to save taxes, right? To keep you out of probate court. There might be, I'm going to give an example a little bit later, but the trust protector can have similar powers to a court, but keeps it out of court. And now a trust protector is typically an attorney or a law firm who's given the power to allow, who's given the power to allow the trustee to do the right thing, okay, and modify the terms of the trust to conform to the grantor's intent. So this is a real world example. We met some clients, and the parents jointly owned a ranch with their son. So the parents owned 50% and the son owned 50%, and that ranch was in California. Well, they sold that ranch and then bought, the parents and the son bought another ranch in Texas, 50-50. Same plan. The idea was, and everyone knew, that of course the son was going to get the other half of the ranch, whether it was the California ranch or the Texas ranch. The problem is the parents didn't come in and update their documents. Well, the trust protector, it was our firm, was able to change the terms of the trust to conform to the intent of the person who set the trust up. Otherwise, we would have had to go to court, not only in California, but also in Texas. So we'd have two court proceedings, and there is no guarantee that the outcome would have been the same. So much more efficient. And that's a really good example of how a trust protector can be beneficial for the family to carry out the intent. The whole family, no one disagreed. They all knew what was going on, but the trustee could not distribute that Texas property under the terms of the trust, could not distribute that property to the son without the trust protector involvement. If there were no trust protector, you'd have to go to court. So what's the difference between a will and a trust? Length. A will can be 1 to 20 pages. It's got to be at least one, right? Requires probate, takes effect after death. A trust, maybe 15 to 50, maybe 100 pages, avoids probate, can take effect during lifetime, and private. Wills are public, designed to benefit your creditors. A trust is designed to benefit the people and the causes that you care about. So if you don't have kids and you say, Jim, you keep talking about kids. Well, let's say you leave it to charity, right? Nonprofits. A living trust is designed to benefit the people that you want to leave your assets to above or more than the creditors. And probate has a mandatory procedure where you actually have to affirmatively notify the creditors and say, hey, creditor, you got 4 months to come in and make your claim. There is no similar requirement for a living trust. You do not have to notify creditors. Creditors must come after an estate within 1 year of the date of death. Most creditors, 1 year of the date of death, but having only a will and no living trust subjects you to probate. Changing laws, very, very important. We briefly mentioned the Corporate Transparency Act. This was under a Defense Authorization Act. This is basically to get money launderers and terrorists, okay? The problem is it's affecting everybody. So if you have an LLC or you have a corporation, you need to find out if you are required to report certain information to the government before January 30th of 2025. I mean, it's a very narrow window, right? And if you're watching this after, January 30th, 2025, yeah, you're late on that one. But there are some exceptions to it, but it expands the anti-money laundering laws and it's intended to help prevent and combat fraud. So why am I mentioning this if you have a living trust? Because if you have an LLC and a person dies, that is probably going to require you to notify the federal government of the change, and you got a 30-day window, right? So very important to pay attention to. This is why when people say, oh, when somebody passes away, don't do anything for a year. Well, if you don't do anything for a year, the penalty is $500 a day, actually indexed to inflation. So it's, I think it's $515 a day. It's a penalty, daily penalty, up to 2 years in prison. So very serious. This now is part and parcel of what we call trust administration and probate administration. So when somebody dies, whether it's a will or a living trust, you're going to have to deal with this. So very, very important. It is you, and we've got our time limits here, but we have a whole other webinar on this. That is a Corporate Transparency Act. And we will open up for questions. If you're watching this on YouTube, please go ahead and keep watching because the next video is just going to appear. So thank you for joining us, and please subscribe to our YouTube channel.